Hey, hockey heads, get ready for the Daily Faceoff Playoff Parlay Challenge. Each game day, answer four questions. Pick the winning team, guess if points will be over or under, predict the first goal, and choose the highest scoring period. Daily winners snag gift cards, while each round's champs pocket cold, hard cash. Play now at games.dailyfaceoff.com and prove your puck prowess. It's fast, it's fun, and it's all about hockey. Let's go.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, this is Dave Pullen. You're on Nasty Knuckles.
Listening to Nasty Knuckles, the Hockey Outlaws podcast, with your hosts, Derek Nasty Suttermeyer and former Philadelphia Flyer enforcer Riley Cote, as they go behind the scenes with your favorite NHL players. Time to face off.
All right, welcome back. What's happening, Nasty?
What's up, Riggs? What are you saying? What do you got going on,
I'm
buddy?
Excited. New location here.
Debo said change it up today.
Yes, he did.
So we listened. We listened to him.
Two eppies this week. You got to change it up.
Got to change it up a little bit.
Sipping on some clear this morning?
I was.
You were?
I was. More than sips. That's the second bottle. I just put the new one up, just so you're aware.
Well, no wonder you can't focus this morning.
Oh, my God.
Rallying you.
Yeah, I see your handwriting. Now, I wish people could see what I'm witnessing right now. But
I was
anyway.
With my right hand, so.
Yeah, I got you.
So what's happening?
Not much, man, since we last talked 2 days ago.
Yeah.
With our last pod. Only thing Flyers had going on was they played home against the Kings.
Yes.
And they ended up losing in overtime. Good game. They fought back. Torts seemed to be happy with their play. I said they looked really slow at first, but picked it up. And they got another point. So I know you're hoping and praying on Bedard, but the more points you get, it is not happening.
Yeah, it's not happening. Never thought it would, but...
I don't want to lose anyway.
No,
no one
who
likes losing.
Who does?
So
no one's deliberately tanking. So, honest effort.
Yeah.
Squeeze out a point.
Yeah.
Again, continuing with their momentum the last, 13, 14 games, squeezing out points and trending in the right direction anyways.
Yeah, for sure.
What else? Talk in action.
Talk wins his first game and gets booed.
Wow.
And
a jersey
came on the ice, too, is what Baller told me. I actually missed that, but it happens.
It happens.
It happens. They got shit kicked the next night,
mm-hmm.
last night, unfortunately. But wishing him all the best, man. He's a good dude. We're going to get to run into him when we get out to Van in a few weeks.
Absolutely. So. And there was a nice little tribute by Biz on TNT there with the King, Henrik Lundqvist, playing the Green Day song, Time of Our Life.
I know.
And he did a hell of a job.
He did well.
I almost was in tears.
Were you? You're a sensitive guy, Cuddles.
Sensitive, I mean,
I think that's where that name came from. But, one really cool thing last night, Ridly Gregg. Played his first NHL game last night for Ottawa. He was drafted 28th overall in the first round in 2020. And he assisted on Claude Giroux's goal last night.
Yep.
They ended up winning the game 2-1. And his dad, Mark Gregg, a good friend of ours, played a little bit with the Flyers, played mainly with the Phantoms, played in Hartford. He was drafted number 15 overall way back in 1990.
Yep.
So it was really cool to see Ritter get his first game, you know, send him out there, no Bucky. yeah. you know, for his little lap. And
third star.
Yep, third star of the game. It was really, really cool. So congratulations yeah. to...
Proud Pops, too,
yeah, Ritter, yeah, and G and Twiggy, his wife, yeah. Pretty cool night.
Yeah, no doubt. Would be exciting as a father, especially yes. playing the game and you know, being connected to the Flyers. He's scouting for the Flyers, and he was a sniper, man. He was a sniper.
Yeah. Player, oh, gee, yeah. If the game was where it is now, you know, the way the game's played, he would have NHL's whole career. Like yeah. he scored, he did everything.
Yeah.
Really good player. He was a captain of the Phantoms for years. And one of my good buddies, so
yeah.
really, really cool to see.
Well, wish him the best. Hopefully, he can stick up for yeah. a little while, and
that'd be nice.
Make a mark.
Make some money.
Yeah, absolutely. Nas, we got a special guest here.
We
in the
do.
House. Today we have Adam Bortz, who is the director of the Lehigh Valley Winter Classic, in the house talking about this upcoming event February 4th in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
Come on into Adam, the new studio, Adam.
Welcome.
Get in here.
What's
somebody
happening?
Got a phone book I can stand yeah, on?
Prop this guy
I'd be
up.
Tough though with you two on my wing. Yeah. I'll tell you that.
Thanks so much for having us on, guys. Really, really appreciate you letting us use your platform to kind of talk about what we do and who we help.
Yeah, no, thanks awesome. For coming out, making the trek from Lehigh Valley. Why don't you talk a little bit about the event? I've participated in the past. Awesome event, what you guys do, and happy to support again. So,
yeah, thanks. This is your third time, I believe,
third time,
out there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Awesome. Happy to have you again. I'll give you, like, kind of the elevator pitch of what this is, and then maybe we can unpack a couple pieces of it here and there. But the elevator pitch is, this is an outdoor hockey event, outdoor hockey game in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And it goes from like 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. at night. There's about 18 teams that play in it. And the reason for its existence, the sole reason it exists, is to serve as a fundraising vehicle for Lehigh Valley Special Hockey, this Polar Bears team that's a special needs team. They kind of like adapt the game for individuals with cognitive and physical disabilities.
It's amazing. Yeah, yeah, and again, I've been there before and seen the work you guys do. I've participated in some of these polar bear practices and have
yep.
built relationships with some of the players. It's amazing, right? It's just yeah. giving these players an opportunity to get ice time and community and the whole bit. So amazing work you're doing, and happy to support. You know, being able to drum up a few Flyers alumni too along the way.
Absolutely.
Help support the events. So.
Yeah, we're going to have, along with Ryder this year, we're going to have Bill Clement back. He's been kind of a staple for the past couple years and has helped us out a ton. Tremendous human being. And Scott Hartnell is going to be there as well.
Oh, bird dog.
Yeah.
Nice.
So, yeah,
nice
we're real pumped. And it's free to the public. From, I believe, 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock, we're going to have you guys signing autographs and, you know, meeting people and fans and talking to them and stuff like that. And then I believe you're going to be coaching a period or so for yeah. the special hockey teams that are going to play. So we're really looking forward to that.
Yeah. Well, Adam, I am going to promise you that I will work on his signature yeah. over the next
it's a little
days.
Rough. It's a little rough, yeah, to say the least. At least you know it's mine.
Yes, that's a good point. Good point. But
forging that one.
Yeah. Well, what a great event, man.
Thanks.
It's so awesome.
Yeah.
And it's really important. And a couple things I just want to communicate to everybody listening today. I'll give you three examples kind of why I think this is a really important event. The first example, you know, there's these junior coaches that we have, and we give them scholarships every year. I sit on the board, and there's like a form that, you know, you can fill out, and parents can give like recommendations of why this particular coach is so great and why they're so deserving of a scholarship. And one of them that sticks out in my mind was this kid was there for, I don't know. And these kids, like, in high school are way more mature than I know I was at that age, for sure. But they, this one particular kid formed a relationship with a player. And the family had said one day in school, you know, I guess their child special needs is in, like, a special needs classroom. When I went to school, they were kind of separated from the rest of the population.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this kid passes his coach in the hallway and gives him a fist bump. And like, if it weren't for this organization even existing, that interaction would never have happened. The family's like, it's changed our kid's life. Like,
yeah, that's
it's so important.
Meaningful, right?
Yeah. And like, you know, if we don't do what we do and fundraise for this organization, stuff like that wouldn't happen. You know,
that's super awesome. That's
and you know, the second kind of reason I think this is super important is I have a lot of parents come up to me during the event, and this kind of happens every year in a little bit different way, but I'll give you kind of the synopsis. Is a parent will come up and say, like, you know, when we found out about our child's diagnosis, we had thought, like, they're not going to have any friends. They're never going to any parties. They're not going to have the same childhood that a kid without special needs would have, you know? And through special hockey, they're able to go to kids' birthday parties. They have friends. They go to away games. They are on the bus, and we know how important that is, and that time you spend with your boy, you know? So, like, that would not have happened if we don't do what we do, and that's really cool. And then the third thing I think, you know, that I don't often talk about when I speak about it publicly, that my wife, like, drilled into my head today that she wanted to remind me to speak about, is how important this is for the parents as well. You know, we always talk about the kids and what it does for their development, and that stuff's awesome and it's great. But, like, okay, I have a two-year-old, and she freaked out in the lobby of a Target the other day and had this, like, meltdown. And a parent, a special hockey parent, could have a 14-year-old with autism have that same episode. Right. And I can say, oh, my daughter too, man, I know what that feels like. I'm so sorry. But, like, I don't. I have no idea what that is like. And now, through growing what we've grown, you know, we've been able to cultivate this community of all these other families that know exactly how that feels.
Yeah, right.
And it's so important, you know, and the moms can get together on wine night and just talk about it and be there for each other. And that's really important. You know, when we started the program, this is our 10th year, I think there was about 5 families that were involved. And they had to pay for everything. They bought their skates, they bought their sticks, they paid for ice time. I don't think they were going to, maybe, you know, like, 5 away games, maybe a season at that point. And over the course of what we've done, we've raised about $350,000 now.
Wow.
We've grown their program to, I think it's 37 families now, and it's completely subsidized.
Wow.
They have home jerseys, away jerseys. They go to tournaments. They do the buses. They have banquets. And they don't pay a dollar. Wow. And and it's, you know, all the donations and all of those corporate sponsorships that we get go directly to that. We don't take any proceeds. We don't turn a profit. It goes right to the kids and their families. And it's super important that everybody listening, you know, donate. If you can't donate, I would say like or share even this podcast, you know, and help us get the word out about what we're doing. It goes a really long way.
Yeah, that's awesome. 100%. Super powerful stuff. You know, you say hockey is for everybody. It really is, right? And you mentioned the community, but it's like that family that's cultivated within the locker room. Hockey is, sports are special, right? But
big time. There's
something really special about the hockey community, and people band together and support each other, and
absolutely
creating that community, as you mentioned, is super, super important.
For sure. For sure. And a community that, you know, those kids may not have been a part of, you know, and it's just, I love what we do. We're so blessed to do it. And, you know, we want to keep doing it for the foreseeable future.
Absolutely. Well, I appreciate you hopping on and sharing this with us. Again, remind the viewers and listeners, the date and time, one more time.
Just sure. So it's Saturday, February 4th at Bethlehem Municipal Ice Rink. And it starts about 8 a.m., goes to about 10 p.m. And free autographs, meet and greet with the guys are from 1 to 2.
Awesome.
There's food, there's cheesesteaks, there's fries. Like, come hungry.
Nasty.
You know.
Oh. You better be coming. You love your cheesesteaks.
I haven't had a cheesesteak in forever, but I do want one. You just said that. I'm hungry. Debo, let's go.
Yeah, yeah. You get your milkshakes there, too.
Yeah.
There.
Oh, here we go. Adam, I apologize for this guy. But seriously, thank you for coming on, man. This is a great event, and I know it's so important, and for everything you just said, it kind of explains it all. So,
happy to support. Looking forward to it. I'm going to bring my girls and have a good time there. So,
can't wait.
Appreciate you making the trek and supporting us here and hopping on. So,
and Riggs, we have another event coming up.
We do.
And you have a great story about where we're going. We have Fans of Philly.
Yes.
Coming up. We are going to Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
End of the Roxy. I mean, Van.
Oh, yeah.
But we're starting off in Seattle. See our buddy Dave Haxtall. It's going to be awesome. But we have a great story real quick that Adam told us about his visit this week out there. You got to tell the listeners, please.
Yeah, so I was out in Seattle for work, and I ended up swinging by the Kraken practice facility, and this thing is like unbelievable, state of the art. Just aesthetically, it's gorgeous, but like the tech and all of the new stuff in it is unlike anything I've ever seen before, right? So I'm watching the Zam go around the ice after one of these little kids' practices, and this thing shoots up out the back. The thing looks like a bass boat. There's like this dashboard with all these buttons and lights and all this stuff. I'm like, what is going on here? So I stop the Zam driver after he gets off, and he's like dumping his ice and stuff. And I'm like, what is that? Like, what's going on here? Why does it sound like a Prius? You know, it's like not loud, you know? And I'm like, okay. So he starts telling me, you know, there's this laser eye mounted to the wall where the Zam door is. And it like looks out over the ice and figures out, extrapolates where all the low and the high spots are on the ice. And this thing tells the Zamboni how to raise and lower the blade to cut the ice the most mathematically perfect sheet you could possibly imagine. And like a typical Zamboni has, you know, those little water jets that spout out and then the towel comes out the back and it smooths it and, you know, a little bit. This doesn't have that. It's got these like, I don't know, 100 little Mr. nozzles on the back of it. And the same thing tells each Mr. exactly the frequency of water to spray out the back again to make this thing like glass. So every cut is consistent and it's beautiful. So this guy is like, you know, showing me around and showing me like where they dump the ice and all this other stuff. And we start to talk and I'm telling him about the event, you know, that we just talked about. And he's like, Lehigh Valley, I know exactly where that is. I'm from Anaheim. And you know, I'm like, how do you know that? You're from Anaheim, you know? And he's like, well, my brother played in Lehigh Valley for a little bit and he's on the Flyers now. I'm like, dude, no, like, okay, yeah, right? So he starts showing me family pictures and it's freaking Cam York's brother.
Wow.
So if you guys are in Seattle at all, you know, look for the dude with the mullet. It's Cam York's brother and tell him you love the Flyers. Yeah.
I want to say Zamboni ride.
Yeah, I know, right?
Thing.
You want to check this thing out, man.
So Yorkie, we'll have to talk to you about that, Yorkie. But it's a great story. We started laughing.
Yeah, I know. That's amazing great. Technology where it's going. Hey, who would have thought the Zamboni could be improved that much? But I guess that's where it's going, right? Yeah. I mean, you got to increase that quality of light or quality of ice.
Yeah.
Well, for youth hockey players, but specifically the pros, and you invest that kind of money into a building. But super cool. Yeah, yeah, we're looking forward to checking that out. Hopefully, we can get over there while we're in Seattle.
All right,
Nast.
You know what time it is.
I know what time it is. Episode 103. With our good friend Dave Poulin, former captain of the Philadelphia Flyers. This episode is presented to you by Curaleaf. Welcome to Curaleaf, a medical marijuana dispensary. Whether you're a longtime patient or you're just getting acquainted with this incredible plant, Curaleaf of Pennsylvania is honored to guide you along your medical marijuana journey. Have questions? Google Curaleaf PA or stop by one of their 18 locations across the Commonwealth or visit cureleaf.com/locations. Nasty, you're already sleeping. Let's go.
Let's go.
Welcome back. I'm Riley Cote.
And I'm Derek Settlemyer. And this week, we are so pleased to have a former Flyers captain. This guy's done it all, actually. TSN analyst, player, been in management, coached, the Moose, Mr. Dave Poulin. Dave, what's going on, my man?
Well, that's a nickname I don't hear often anymore.
I remember that as a kid. I remember that.
That's so funny. And nicknames are different in different places for me, actually. I've had a few different ones along the way. And when I visit and, you know, I see someone like Paul Holmgren, I'm like, hey, Moose, how you doing? And people turn around like, who is he talking to? Oh, yes, I did have a different life and I had a few different lives. But, you know what, I had such a fun and great ride in Philly. From 83 to 90 and just a great bunch of guys and keep in touch with a number of them. And through that time, I was probably Pooley or Moose most of the time through those years, I would say to most.
Normally being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
To the people.
Yeah, I remember that being a kid coming up to visit Sudsy, my dad, and I just remember guys calling you that. So it's funny.
The genesis of the name, Derek, was we all worked at the same gas station in high school, and we had a great job. So the gas station was right next to the high school, and we could go over, and there were two different shifts, but the owner let us work out the schedule so we could work around our hockey schedules. So it was great. You know, you can work 2 days a week pumping gas and make a little bit of spending money. And when I walked in to get the job, I was 15 years old, and I was with a defenseman on our team. And when I was 15 years old, I was 5'3", and he was 6'3". He was big, tall, rangy kid, you know. And so they called me every name in the books, right? I was Shorty, I was Stretch, I was a million different names. And one day, one of the mechanics called me Moose. And from that day forward, I was Moose at the gas station. Wow. And my paychecks were made out to Moose Poulin. I mean, the owner, I don't even think he knew I had a name. My sister worked at the bank so we could cash the checks. But and then it died down. I wasn't Moose in college. And it might have been one of my first games in Toronto. The boys had a big bed sheet up on the end of the rink. And it said, "You're in Moose country." And it was Paul Holmgren that picked it up. And from that day forward, with the Flyers, I was Moose.
Oh, wow, awesome. Super interesting. Yeah, I appreciate you sharing that story.
That's
great.
I
had no idea.
So what are you up to these days? Kind of tell us what's going on in your world.
So I've been back in TV, or back in Canada in TV for 9 years now, which is really hard to believe. This is 9 full seasons. And I had come back to Toronto to work for the Leafs when Brian Burke took over the Leafs in 2009. I was working in private industry in Chicago. I'd stepped away from hockey completely for a couple of years. And I came back as the vice president of hockey operations for the Leafs. I did that for 5 years. And then when Brendan Shanahan came in 2014, he basically changed out the whole staff. And so I didn't know what I was going to do. It was the summer. It was late July of 2014. And I thought, well, I'm back in Canada. I'd been back for 4 or 5 years, and I'm just going to hang out and see what happens. And actually, both TV networks, the TV deal in Canada had just changed, and the big deal had just been signed, the big 12-year deal. And both networks called, and the first network was Sportsnet that got the deal. And they said, you know, we've got all kinds of opportunity here. We've just signed a 12-year deal. We're going to be the national provider. You know, you can do color, you can do studio, you can do, we'll try you wherever you'd like. You've got all kinds of opportunity. And the next day I met with TSN and the executive producer of hockey there, he said, you know what? We really don't have anything for you. We don't know where we're going regionally, and we don't have any seats or any opportunity at all. And I kind of laughed. I said, yeah, I think I'll take that one. Because I didn't know if I wanted to do TV. Actually, when I was walking in, it was shortly after I'd been fired, and I was walking in to meet the first meeting, and a team called. And they said, look, you know, we'd like you to come to work for us. And I said, well, like, when? And they said, well, like, right now. And I said, well, I'm literally walking in. I'm standing outside a restaurant. I'm going to meet with an executive producer. And I don't really think I want to do TV, but, you know, and I'm going to talk to them. And he said, well, give me a ring back. You've got a job here. Just know that right now. And so I had all these things swirling through my head, and I needed to really sit back and see what I wanted to do. And I thought TV was a good seat to do that from. I had no intentions of making it a full-time gig. And I started out on a show called That's Hockey Tonight, TH2N. And that would have been in all the locker rooms around the country. It was a late night show. And you know, I had no real training or anything, and just kind of sat in a couple nights and then jumped in and gradually just did more and more. So to explain where I'm at today, I arguably sit in 7 or 8 totally different silos, all with TSN. Well, not all, actually not all with TSN. So the first channel would be with the Leafs. We have 4 regional teams. With the Leafs, I do the studio panels. So, okay. You know, 26, 28 games, and the main panel is James Duffy and Jeff O'Neill and Darren Dreger and myself. It started out to be Bobby McKenzie, and he retired. Cheryl Pounder is also a big part of it now. And then the second part is Color for Montreal. And so 2 totally different jobs. Sitting in the studio is totally different from prepping to do color. And that's been about 5 or 6 years now. And I'll do 32, 34 Montreal games this year, either in Montreal or wherever they are on the road. I'll do either or panel or studio for Ottawa, and then, or color or panel. And then I'll also do Winnipeg games, and that's mostly studio work.
Wow.
And from there, the shows, SportsCenter, That's Hockey with Gino Retta, I'll do portions of those. I'll jump in there. I'll do radio, I'll do regular radio hits around the country. I do Sirius, which comes into the U.S. on Tuesday mornings, and do some of the TSN networks in. I do Winnipeg, I do Ottawa, I do Toronto. And then I write, which is really crazy. I'm writing an article right now, and a friend of mine got involved with the ownership of the Toronto Star, so big national newspaper. And he called me one day and he said, "Hey, do you want to write?" And I said, "Write what?" He said, "Well, you can write whatever you want." And I thought, well, I've never written. Like, I've never done this. I've never tried it. So he said, "Well, just, you know," he said, told me the length. And so I wrote 5 pieces just on my own to see what does 1,200 words even look like? I don't even know what that looks like. And I don't know how long it would take to think it through. So I wrote one about my golf course. I wrote one about American Thanksgiving, like not even hockey related topics, just to see if I could put words to paper. If you can sit down with a piece of paper and write something down. And I thought, well, you know, I might be able to do this. I wrote my 80th article.
Wow.
Last Sunday. So I write every Sunday in the Toronto Star. This is my 3rd year. I'm stunned that I've come up with topics. So I don't write about a game specifically. I write about something. And so, you know, like recently I would tell you, I wrote about Guy Lafleur's, you know, the passing of Guy Lafleur, and a couple of stories about me playing against him. But I was in the Montreal Forum the night they did the tribute. So the Leonard Cohen song, just phenomenal. You know, the Frank Sinatra, I Did It My Way. And so I just kind of write like kind of offbeat columns. The one I'm working on today, I did Tuesday night's game against Boston. And so I'm just shaping it out right now, but it's going to be something along the theme of what does a 5-loss team look like in late January? Like,
yeah, right.
Wow. Like a 5 losses, guys.
It's 5. Crazy.
And so I sort of write the why and how of it. And you know, I'll talk to people through the process. I talk to a lot of people in the game at all different levels, and back to, you know, what I do in my day job, as I would put it, when something happens in the game, if I'm doing color and something happens in the game tonight, am I going to say what happened as a player, as a coach, as a manager, as a fan, as an analyst? And so that's what I really love about it. You know, like I'm going to watch, I don't know, take a Nick Suzuki tonight, and he's going to, so here's a good example. The other night, Nick Suzuki, 8-0 against Patrice Bergeron in the first period in the faceoff circle.
Wow.
That's impressive.
8-0. And so he was 9-0, but he'd beaten Patrice 8 times. And so that to me is, now I'm starting to tell it from Patrice's angle and saying, okay, if I'm a coach, I walk up and I just hand Patrice the game sheet after the first, so he remembers maybe that he's a shocking 0-8. He runs it like 63%. He's one of the best faceoff guys in the league. So I said to my broadcast partner on air, what they took the opening faceoff second period. I said, Nick Suzuki has no chance on this faceoff. He may not even touch the puck. And Patrice won it so clean, and he ended up just under 500. But things like that are fun to talk about on air and just to see little nuances like that. And so I consider the fact that I probably have 6 or 8 different jobs in life, and the way my life has gone, you know, I've changed jobs that many times. Like I've changed and done different things. And so maybe the final piece of it is kind of put it all together, but still from a whole bunch of different seats.
That's amazing. Yeah. I was going to say, you obviously don't have a whole lot of free time. I wouldn't think with all that going on.
What's funny about that though, Derek, is I feel like I do. I really do. And I've got my schedule structured pretty well now, and I'm able to work from home on some of those things I talked about. And I feel like I have more time now than I've ever had, which is crazy. It really is. So it's a game afternoon. I did a lot of my prep yesterday, which was an off day in Montreal. I did a couple of radio shows in the morning yesterday. And so this article will go in Sunday's paper, but I've structured it and I'm writing it Thursday afternoon. And what would I be doing Thursday afternoon? So I don't feel like that's work. You know, I've got all my prep done for Detroit and Montreal tonight. And this will feel really good though. The writing is it's the deadline thing, right?
Like, yeah, right.
It's like, you know, and there have been times when I've gotten writer's block, guys, and I've talked to writers about it, professional writers, and said, you know, does this happen to you? Like, oh man, absolutely it happens. No question about it. But it's not like I need a challenge, but it's arguably the most challenging thing I do to come up with something fresh to say on Sundays.
Wow. Yeah, I can imagine. You've really embodied this whole media thing, right? I mean, you're doing it all. You're doing obviously the TV, the color, yeah. Now you're writing, radio. I mean, it's pretty impressive. I mean, if it seems suiting for you, you know, as your character seems to show throughout your track record, is that you just kind of embody wherever you are in life and what you're doing.
I like people, Riley.
Yeah.
And I think we're spoiled in the game of hockey. Mm-hmm. I think we still have some of the greatest people in sport. I really do.
I agree.
And, you know, I drop into the rink this morning and see some people that I know over the years, and some of them are writers and, you know, different people like the coach of the Detroit Red Wings, Derek Newsy Lalonde, was a young college guy when I was in the college game, and he was at a Division III college, and you watch a kid like that work his way up through the USHL, and he's a head coach in the NHL right now.
Yeah.
And for me to have a conversation with him this morning, or, you know, when I see Detroit Riley, it's just fun. And it's a labor of love. It really is. And, you know, and the best part of it tonight will be, you know, I'll meet my broadcast partner, Brian Mudrick, about 4:45 in the lobby, and we'll go over to the rink and get set up. We'll do a couple pregame hits. We'll do a hit for That Talkie from our studio that'll drop into that show at 7:00. And then the game starts and you're fired up. It's a game. Like I'm looking forward to seeing it. I saw Detroit a couple times early in the year. They're a team that's on the rise, as is Montreal, and they're down pretty low right now. But I think both teams are headed in the right direction. So an intriguing story for me. Can Stevie Eisenman do in Detroit what he did in Tampa?
Yeah.
You know, he didn't reap the benefits in Tampa. He wasn't there technically for the cup, but it's his stamp all over it.
100%.
All over it. And if you look closely at Detroit, some of the same pieces are in place. You know, Moritz Seider, is that his young Victor Hedman? And you know, he's got a young kid, Simon Evanson, who's 6'6", who plays in the minors at 18 years old. And he's drafted his first round goalie, Sebastian Kosa. Is that kid going to be Vasilevsky? And, you know, who's going to play the role of Cooch and Stammer? Or, you know, is Lucas Raymond going to be one of those guys? So that part of it is fun. I think about hockey in a whole bunch of different ways, and sort of the outlets I have to do it and to talk about it just make it fun.
Yeah, exactly what you're talking about. I wanted to ask, like, you played, you coached hockey operations, like you wear, you know, you've worn different hats and you have different perspective, which is important when you're talking, you know, to the public around hockey, right? It's just like these different angles around the game that a lot of people may not think about, which I think is important.
Absolutely. And, you know, and quite frankly, when I've moved on from one, I haven't really wanted to go back to it or missed it. When I was done playing, I was done playing. I mean, I played for 13 years. I was 37 years old. I started late as a U.S. college player for 4 years, and then I played a year in Europe before my career. But when I was done, I was done. And the opportunity to come back to go back to Notre Dame and coach. Now, I didn't think I was ever a coach. And even after coaching 10 years, guys, I don't consider myself like a coach. Like, I'm not wired like that. You guys both know coaches. And they're wired differently. And and I didn't feel like I was wired like that at all. And that opportunity just arose. I was playing in Washington my last year, and it was a lockout year. And the phone rang on a Sunday afternoon, and I was watching an NFL playoff game with my neighbor. And we just, cell phones were fairly new at the time. And I remember looking at the phone and saying, that's a weird number. And it was someone from Notre Dame. And Notre Dame is a real small university, despite its name and, you know, and notoriety over the years. And they said, listen, they're going to make a coaching change in the hockey department. Would you be interested? And I'm like, to do what? And they said, well, I'm a coach. And I said, well, I'm a player. I'm not a coach. And they said, well, you know, the program's been through some tough times and we need someone to come back. And basically, and Notre Dame is Notre Dame. They're funny about it. Basically, you have to do this. I'm like, what do you mean I have to? You have to. I have to do it. But, you know, the idea was to raise the girls in one place. And my daughters at the time, two of them were 9 and one was 5. And we'd already moved, you know, from Philly to Boston to Washington. And it was like, if you stay in the business, you're going to move. So it was an opportunity to go back and raise them in a small town. And that's why we made the decision to go. But I still maintain after 10 years, I wasn't a coach. And just, you know, we had some good teams, had some good players, and we got the NCAA tournament and did some things. But I much preferred the management side, kind of 10,000 feet, looking over the top, you know, consulting with coaches. And when I was in my position in Toronto, one of my favorite things I developed with two guys who could be pretty crusty. It took me some time, but eventually with Ron Wilson was my first head coach. Randy Carlisle was my second. And I would have breakfast with those guys every game day. And you might imagine the first time that happens, right? It's like you walk into their office, it's, you know, 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning on game day. And, you know, the first few times you just have a coffee and there's breakfast all set up in the locker room. You just have your coffee and they're having breakfast and you sit and have your coffee. And then one morning you get brave and you bring your breakfast in there. And, you know, but it led to just some great conversations and getting to know a coach one-on-one and getting to him to vent, you know, to someone in management. So things like that. Just so much fun for me. And so but that being said, I haven't missed being a manager. And had some opportunities to get back in and have chosen not to. And it's a tough job, boy. It really is.
It really
is. Multi-pronged job. I think what you're going to see in the future is a setup similar to Montreal, where there's basically two general managers here, right? I mean, there is, you know, with the way they've got it set up, Jeff Gorton took the job as senior vice president. And then Kent Hughes, a first time general manager, took the job as general manager. I would look at it as a management team. And I think it takes two people. I really do. It's such a hard job right now.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that. I mean, the Flyers have done something similar with Chuck Fletcher and bringing Danny Briere in there. And then, you know, they also have, the capologist, which is Barry Hanrahan.
Flyers there as well.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Flyers. Yeah.
Three assistant.
Well, GM. You think about, the cap itself, that's an animal unto its own.
Like, oh, sure.
In my job now, guys, there's not a day when I don't go on that on Cap Friendly. There's not a day. Like, I spend a ton of time on it, just to get the feel of what's going on. And I wasn't our cap guy. Claude Loiselle played that role, but we're all involved and you all have to be involved. It's so complex and so crazy and it dictates your every move.
Yep.
And you do need a person dedicated strictly to that. But, you know, that's a group, a trio in Philly, and that's what it takes. Different personalities, different backgrounds. And we all respect and know too much. And, you know, even going back and looking at Boston guys and, you know, the way they're constructed. Patrice Bergeron is a 2003 draft pick.
I know it's crazy.
20 years ago. That's 20 years.
It's wild, isn't it?
You know, and Krejci's a 2004. And by the way, they were both second rounders. And Marchand's a 2006. And he was a third rounder. And you think, you know, the impatience of life today and how everybody wants everything accelerated and, you know, social media and the outcry, you know, and, you know, another team I cover is Ottawa, and their oldest two draft picks are 2001 from 2015 and one from 2018. You're like,
yeah.
It takes time. Like, yeah. It takes time. It's really hard. It's a hard business today to grow a team, to keep it together with all the different conflicting things, let alone the pandemic and those 3 years, which threw another, you know, wrinkle into the whole thing. It's a tough job.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's for sure it did. I had a question. You kind of brought it up. Riley and I were talking about it. I didn't realize you had gone to Sweden to play when you had finished college. What was the reasoning there?
So I was, when I mentioned my size going in for my first gas station job, I was a really little guy and growing up and through the mid 70s, the funniest thing was I got cut from teams guys because I was too small, because who was the rage of the day? The Big Bad Bruins.
Yeah.
And the Broad Street Bullies.
That's right.
That's right.
And that was the direction of hockey. And if you were too small, you were too small. So I'd be the last guy to make my team. I'd lead the league in scoring. And then the next year they'd say, well, you're not going to be able to do it at this age, you know, and I'd go through the whole process again. So I stepped back entirely when I was 16 years old for a year and a half, played house league with my buddies and didn't play competitive. I mean, played competitive hockey. House league is competitive hockey, but it's all relative.
Yeah.
And stepped right out of it and no thoughts of playing pro at all. And then when I clicked back in for a half a year of juvenile hockey, and you know, which no one played juvenile hockey that was going on to play in the NHL. And then my break was playing tier two for 1 year. And I played with a pretty famous organization called the Dixie Beehives in the Toronto area and got my break there. We were really good. We had one player in particular who had attracted a lot of college interest. So the college scouts started coming out. And I believe 11 kids from that team went to the U.S. on scholarship.
Wow.
11 kids. And impressive. So I had a really, you know, I had really blossoming and coming on as a player. And so all of a sudden I had a stack of scholarship offers in front of me, guys, that were just, because it was all word of mouth, right? And so when a school would call, they'd say, who are you talking to? And I'd say, well, I'm talking to Harvard and Princeton and Michigan State and Michigan and Notre Dame. And they would just, you know, add their interest to the pile. And so I went in to see my high school guidance counselor, and I'd always played for club teams, right? I hadn't played for high school. And I went in, I had this big stack of letters, and he's looking at the schools and he's saying, well, you know, Harvard, Yale, Notre Dame, you can't go to any of those schools. And I said, well, I got some news for you, buddy. I can go if I want to. I'm gonna pay when I go there. And but still no thought of playing pro hockey. And my rookie year at Notre Dame, my freshman year, I was really good. And I had a great, great freshman year. And that was 78, 79. But still no thought of it. And my sophomore year, got really sick. I got meningitis, beat up physically. That took some steam out of me probably for a year and a half. Came back, had a great senior year, and then was set to go to work. Like, you know, I got a great education. Essentially, if you will, used hockey to get my education and didn't need anything more from it. So a late call. I was going to work that summer and a late call in June. So I'm going to work in August. You know, my career's done. And in June, I got a call to see if I'd be interested in going to a Division I team in Sweden. So not the elite series, but the next level down. And they had lost their import late in the year. And it was an American coach. It was Teddy Sater, who went on to coach with the Flyers in New York and Buffalo, that was coaching over there. And he didn't know me. His name was passed on to me. And so he took me sight unseen and then made it his project. He had been in camp with the Flyers the previous year as their skating instructor. Basically, he made it his project to make me into an NHL player. So, you know, the break of breaks, right? One guy who is connected, takes an interest in you, and he has a skill set that can develop your skill set. You know, and so he just took me to a different level. I'd never been told, guys, that I had to be the leading goal scorer on the team. Like, I'd never been told that. And he said to me, you don't understand. When you're in Europe as an import, you have to be the leading goal scorer, not leading point getter, leading goal scorer. So I looked at scoring differently. I just looked at it differently. I was like, okay, well, I could do that. I've just never thought like that. I've always taken more satisfaction out of making a pass to Brian Propp than I did about shooting the puck in the net myself.
Right.
And by the way, you better pass it to Brian Propp.
Exactly. Right.
Only when Tim Kerr wasn't available. But, you know, that was – and you'll hear stories like that. That's one guy taking an interest in a player that he sees something in, and you need a break like that. You absolutely do. I would have been content to go to Europe and play for a year. And then within Sweden, though, I had some opportunities to go up to the Elite Series, and I had some, you know, some offers in Europe. So had the Flyers thing not happened, maybe I would have, you know, maybe I would have stayed in Europe and just made it a career over there. I'd been fine with that. But came back and signed an amateur tryout offer. So came back in late February. Late January. Season's over early over there. It's late January. Late February. I'm all confused here. Mid to late February. And came back and went to Portland, Maine, walked in. Bert Godin and Kevin Cady, the two trainers, met me literally at the airport. And they're like, where are your sticks? I'm like, I don't have sticks. And it was a veteran team. It was a talented team coached by Tommy McVie, the legend.
Oh, yeah.
And I played 16 games there. And once again, everything just connected. The second game, first game, my right winger was Dave Brown. My left winger was Mel Hewitt.
So you had a little bit of room?
Look up Mel Hewitt's numbers, guys. When we're done, look up Mel Hewitt's penalty minute numbers. I think he had like 5-10 one year in the eye.
Wow.
That's on the left side. I got Brownie on my
right. Brownie, yeah.
And I think when I arrived, Brownie had 39 majors at that point.
Jeez.
And so first night I played maybe 6 shifts in New Haven, and I thought, okay, well, obviously I got tons of room out here and I'm not passing to the left. I got a chance of passing to the right.
Yeah.
Before that first game, 3 guys on my own team came up to me and said, hey, you gotta be really careful of Mel. And I said, he's on my team. And they said, yeah, he's taken a couple of his own centermen out. He's a little bit out of control out there. You really keep your head up. So I got my head up for the New Haven Nighthawks. I got my head up for my own left winger.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, this is crazy.
What did I sign up for here?
Yeah,
exactly. And, you know, and then in the second game in Hershey, one of our centermen got hurt. And I got kicked up in the lineup and just started to rip it up. And I played a total of 16 games. And that year, the Flyers were playing the Rangers in the playoffs. And that was the Herbie Brooks Rangers, you know, the Smurfs, and they had all kinds of speed. And so they wanted to inject more speed in the lineup. So I remember one night in Bob McCammon coming to see me play. It was quite a big deal when the head coach of the Flyers was coming to see you play in the minors. But they didn't know much about me, right? And so I played. I walked in, called up on April Fool's Day. Like, seriously? I'm in Duffy's Pancake House in Portland, Maine. The phone rings. It's 8:00. It's a Friday. We're on our way to New Haven to play that night. So my first and last games were against New Haven. So it's like, I don't know, 4 or 5 hour bus ride. And Duffy, who owns the Pancake House, says, it's Keith Allen. And I'm like, yeah, and it's April Fool's. So
yeah.
So I walk over, I get the phone, and he says, Dave, it's Keith Allen. I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
You know, like, who is it?
Yeah.
No, David, it's Keith Allen. And I said, wow. And so he said, we're going to call you up. You're playing tomorrow night in Maple Leaf Gardens.
Wow. Amazing.
Yeah. So played in New Haven that night. And trust me, you couldn't get anywhere near me. I was like, I'm going to the NHL. Nobody's getting near me. Nobody's touching me. And just got up the next morning, took a car service to LaGuardia, flew to Toronto. Walked in the front doors. And, like, I wouldn't know where the player's entrance was. I walk in the front doors, and Usher's looking at me. I got my hockey bag and my sticks. And he's like, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm going to play tonight. So he took me back to the locker room. Practice. So about half the team had already left the locker room after the pregame skate. So there were guys I didn't even see till I walked in the locker room that night. And I'd never been to training camp, so I didn't know one single person. So it's like, yeah, like I knew who Daryl Sittler was. I knew Bobby Clark was. I mean, I was a hockey fan, but didn't know anybody. Right. So really, really strange. And scored in the first period, scored a shorty in the second period. And
jeez.
Yeah, not a bad start.
Not a bad start.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's incredible. I mean, being undrafted and then having your first pro season go from Sweden to, you know,
crazy,
you know, minor leagues to NHL. You know, man, that's crazy. It is crazy.
It's so crazy. And you think of all the different routes and all the different paths, and everyone has a story. It's an unusual one. It's a lot of good fortune along the way, a lot of right place at the right time, and then taking advantage of an opportunity.
Yeah.
You get an opportunity, you better grab a hold of it and take advantage of it. And so, you know, and then to be blessed by the game this many years later, I mean, I'm still in the game.
Yeah.
Who knows where the path would have gone had things been differently, but once again, good fortune along the way and taking advantage of opportunity.
Sorry for the quick break. Just a quick shout out to our sponsor, DLI Commercial, a premier commercial construction and building maintenance company offering support at every phase. Thank you for your support. Check them out at DLI Commercial for all your construction needs. Back to the show.
Well, yeah, you brought up in that first game there, a shorthanded goal. You scored a pretty big shorthanded goal in the playoffs, and I just remember coming off the couch, like losing my mind. The Flyers were down 5-3. I'll let you tell it, but I mean, that was one of the best shorthanded goals, you know, and what a time to get it.
That's the one guys would talk about the most. When I see people in Philly, and I still do get back there often, that's what people will talk about. And it was a couple of different things. I'd broken two ribs in the second game of that series, and this was in game six. So I'd sat out games three and four and came back and played in five, getting nerve blocks, and then played in six. And in that series was all about Pelle Lindbergh, who was just phenomenal in that series. And that was the youngest team in pro sports that year. And we were a bunch of kids. I mean, you think of the ages. So Derek Smith and Zezel would have been 19 years old. Tockett would have been 20. The twins were 20, Ronnie and Richie Sutter. Murray Craven might have been 21. He might have only been 20. I was just a bunch of kids.
Yeah.
And, you know, we ripped through the first couple of rounds, and now we're playing Quebec. And so up 1-0 in the game, second period, down two men. And I picked off a pass at the top of the circles in our end. So I had a breakaway literally for 3/4 of the ice. That's a really long way to skate.
And you were flying.
And way too long a time to think for a non-goal scorer.
Right? I was going to ask you that.
Oh, man. Well, Murray Craven, I could hear his voice just ingrained in my head about going upstairs. You got to go upstairs. And got a great shot up under the crossbar, and that made it 2-0. So essentially a 2-goal swing, because at 5-3, they were looking to maybe go up 2-1 in the game.
Right.
And, you know, had they won it, they were going home for game seven. So, but I think the biggest thing about the goal, we ended up winning that game 3-0. The biggest thing about the goal, we were going to the Stanley Cup Finals.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, we were going to the Stanley Cup Finals. And that night, it's a different feel. The first time you're going there, and I was able to go three times in my career, again in 87 and then in 90 with the Bruins. But man, the first time you're going to play for the Stanley Cup, the thoughts that go through your head, it's a crazy thought process. It really is.
Yeah, it was amazing. And it's funny you brought up the ribs. My dad was telling me about the needle they were putting in your ribs for the nerve block. And he was like, they put you in a chair and you kind of sit there, and this needle like was kind of like not rubber, but it moved, like, so they'd have to get up under his rib cage.
Oh man.
And he said he would just be a puddle, just sweating. But he's like, sometimes it could take 10 to 15 minutes, or it could take 30 minutes. Like, I guess trying to get it in there, you would know better than me, but
yeah, it wasn't very good.
Couldn't have tickled. That's for sure.
Not very much fun. So like, I went to see a doctor recently, and I just had a little bit of pain in my neck. And he said, "Did you ever break ribs?" And I go, "Ooh,
yeah,
because I broke three in '87, spirally in the playoffs again. Barry Beck hit me. So I've had a couple of experiences along the way like that, but that was just a that was such a fun night. And I, it's one of the I'm not a big memorabilia guy, but I have a picture that somebody took from the balcony right above the goal. And it's just a little 8x10. And I've still got that framed in my office. That's it's a perfect, awesome. I've just released the puck. I'm still about 20 feet clear of the closest defender, Mario Marois. Mario Gosselin was the goaltender.
Yep.
Goose Gosselin. And you can see the puck right up underneath the bar, but it's a really cool shot.
That's awesome.
Somebody, I don't even know how it ended up with me, but somebody either sent it through to somebody or somehow it ended up, you know, on my desk one day. It's a pretty cool picture.
Yeah, it's wild. Well,
you know, that was a huge goal, and they still show it sometimes on the screen whenever they're doing some videos. But
it's not black and white, is it?
No, it is not. It is not black and white.
Close though.
you brought up 87 going back to the finals, and one of the biggest goals again, JJ Daniel scored in that 6-4-7. Like, I remember my dad just saying he thought the roof was coming off that building when he scored. Yeah, that
most
goal.
People will say that's the loudest they've ever heard the building during my yep. time. And the funny thing is, JJ wasn't supposed to be on the ice, right? Because Gretz was on the ice, and JJ knew that when Gretz was on the ice,
it was changed.
We just talked about that recently, and so he ended up going out and getting the biggest goal of his career.
Yeah.
And that year, you know, we'd gone through what we'd gone through at Pelevinberg, and that yeah. year was all about Hex. I mean, Hex was – I was fortunate, man. I played with some good goalies. You know, you're talking now, and when I'm in the business, somebody will say, well, you know, they won, but they got great goaltending. I'm like, so? They're supposed to get great goaltending.
Yeah.
What do you mean they got great goaltending? He's supposed to be good.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a job, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I was gonna say, you know, you land up obviously becoming the captain of the Flyers. You being an older guy coming into the league, like what was that like? And you took the captaincy from Bobby Clark at the second time being the captain of the Flyers. I mean, that's got to be something special.
It really was, Riley. You know, it's something that I still treasure, that experience. And it was a real, when it happened, it was only my second year in the league.
Yeah.
And Daryl Sittler was supposed to be named captain of that team. That's the direction it was going in. And right before the season started, Sittler got traded. And we'd been in a luncheon downtown, and we thought Sittler would be named captain at that luncheon, and it didn't happen. And so it was maybe a Tuesday, and Thursday the season was opening. And so we had taken the bus downtown. We all get back to the Coliseum, and we all went our separate ways. And then maybe an hour later, I got a call from a reporter that Sittler had been traded to Detroit. And, you know, that's all he knew at that point. And didn't know who was coming back, didn't know who else was in the deal, nothing. But he said, you know, they traded Daryl Sittler. I'm like, oh, wow. And then maybe another 2 hours pass, my phone rings. And I'm not sure whether it was Clarkey or Mike Keenan. One of those two called me and said, could you come back to the Coliseum? And I thought, I'm in the trade.
Like, oh, jeez, yeah.
Getting traded. And so I drove back to the Coliseum. I remember walking into Mike's office and Clarkey was in there, and I sat down. Like, I had no idea why I'm in there, right? Like, talk about being called in the principal's office and not knowing what you did wrong.
Right.
But then remembering everything you did do wrong and one of those things was like,
exactly.
Man, I'm sure I got away with that. It was Mike that said, Dave, you're going to be the next captain of the Philadelphia Flyers. And it was,
it was just
a chill goes over you. And I was so careful, and I don't even know why or how I came up with this thought process, but I was always so careful to say I was following Bobby Clark, not replacing Bobby Clark. Like, no one was going to replace Bobby Clark. Right. Don't put that on me.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
You know, I was following Bobby Clark, but, then your immediate thought is, okay, well, I had a really good rookie year, but now what do they want different? What am I supposed to change? What do you do when you're captain? All those different things. And it was the group of guys around me. Like, we had some excellent leadership in that locker room, and Brad Marsh had been a captain already, in his early 20s in Calgary. Mark Howe, Brad McCrimmon was unbelievable. The dear departed Brad McCrimmon is a leader. Yeah. And then a lot of quieter leaders, you know, emerged, Timmy Curran, Brian Propp in their own way. And then the young guys, Rick Tocchet was on that team, and, you know, he was going to grow into a force, but it was all the support that I had around me. And we didn't officially have leadership groups like they have now, or leadership committees or whatever they call them. But we had a de facto one, and I got a ton of support from those guys. And you just remember when I'd be going in a meeting and a couple of those guys would grab me and say, anything you want, we got your back. And, you know, you'd go in so confident in meetings because you said, that's some pretty tough guys behind me. And it was by committee, and a lot of it was how to figure out how to handle our madman coach at the time, Mike.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
A lot of it. And, you know, was trying to calm the waters and do what we did. And Mike was brilliant in the way he pushed and prodded and cajoled and intimidated and all the different things he did to get out of you what he thought you had. And years later, we were at a wedding of some sort. I'm thinking exactly whose it was. But I played golf with Craig Berube and Scotty Mellenby, and I think Murray Craven was in the group. And begrudgingly, this was post-playing career, begrudgingly, each of them would admit that Mike was arguably their best coach and also who got the most out of them. As much as they
couldn't stand him.
Oh, yeah. Just so challenged, so challenging.
Yeah, Chief actually said that to us as well. That was where I was going to ask you next, just like dealing with, you know, you're the captain, so you're probably that guy that goes in to try to, I don't know,
talk some sense into him
or not. I guess you would walk in there and say that, but try to mediate, I guess, or try to get him off this guy or what, you know. I couldn't even imagine going in there to Uncle Mikey as a kid. That's what I called him. But was that your first time ever dealing with a coach like that, or, you know, he was,
it might have been the first and last.
Yeah.
You know, he was unique. He had a method and he believed in his methodology, and you couldn't argue with the success he had. And I thought there was a different way to do it. And that was a lot of the argument, and I could sense it. I considered myself to be the liaison between the players and the coaches. Like, my responsibility was to help get his message across, because he's the boss.
Right.
And so as the boss, you know, I was going to help him in any way I could to get his message across. And effectively, we were a team, and you know, we got into our share of battles for sure. But once again, the end result was we were a pretty good hockey club.
Yes. How would you say your relationship with him was, considering, you know, how he was and, you know, in your position as a captain?
It was good. He wasn't always fair, Riley. I didn't think he was always fair. But he would justify fairness with result, right? And when he would do something, I'd be like, Mike, you didn't have to do that. Like, you didn't. And I particularly when he was really hard on certain individuals, you know, I professed there'd be a different way to do it. You know, and I'll give you a good example. And I don't know how well you got to know this guy over the years, but, you know, another fellow that left us far too early, Ilkka Sinisalo. Such a kind person and such a, you know, unbelievably talented player. But guess what? If you yelled at Ilkka, you weren't getting more out of him.
Yep.
You just weren't. So for me, my challenge would be to grab Ilkka in the stick room and literally get right up in his face and say in this tone of voice, buddy, we really need you tonight. Like, we need you. Like, you're really good. We need you to be the difference maker tonight. To me, that was more effective with that personality than screaming and yelling at him and telling him, you know, that it just didn't work.
Right.
If you didn't, he scored 39 goals in the National Hockey League. And I asked him one day, I said, you know, you can get 50 goals. He goes, then they'd want 55.
Yeah. Yeah. Really? That's a good point, right?
I mean, it was that good, you know? So for me, it was, I thought, you know, I understood what he was doing. I didn't always agree with what he was doing. And that made it hard for me, because I'd have to go to the guys and say, okay, you know, I'd try and soften it or change the angle or change the delivery a little bit. Different day and age.
Yeah, right.
Different day and age with players.
Yeah, you'll never see that again, right? It's like
I don't think so, Riley.
So much communication now.
I don't. You have to communicate. You absolutely have to. EJ McGuire was a big part of Mike Keenan's success because he was the good cop to Mike's bad cop. The staffs are much bigger now. They weren't big staffs. Certainly the staffs, management and coaches are much bigger now. And, you have to, we found each other probably to vent with and talk to. Whereas now there's probably people available to do that.
Yeah. That's true. It's amazing how much, it's funny you just said that, how much staff has increased. I remember my first year, 93, 94, we could fit all the gear in a moving van. Not a truck, a van. And now it's like a rock show. I've been out 3 years now almost. But traveling, people are like, oh, man, how many trucks did you have? I'm like, about close to 20, 15 to 20. But it's the same with the staff. You're traveling with more staff and all that. It's crazy where it's gone. That's for sure. The whole game.
Yeah. How do you liken the new NHL? I mean, obviously you come from an era where it was, evolved from the Broad Street Bullies, and you're still kind of part of that culture. Obviously evolved a ton since then, skill, the speed, the off-ice strength, conditioning, the nutrition, all these resources for the players. I mean, what's your perspective on the modern day NHL?
I like the game. I don't like all the components of the game.
Mm-hmm.
The skill level is off the charts. I don't know if that makes you a better hockey player.
Right. That's a good point.
I think they
can do some skilled things that I would never dream of doing. I'm not sure you're a better hockey player than I am. And that's all the way around. And, the best players could play in any generation. I don't think there's a question about that. And as much as speed is, it's faster, I'm not sure it's better. I think there's an art to slowing the game down. I think there's an art to, to pace. I think someone that thinks and is creative with their mind can make up for any speed deficiency. I mean, you talk about a Patrice Bergeron, not a burner. There's a young kid in Winnipeg I really like. And I remember the knock in the draft being, he's not quite a burner. His name is Cole Perfetti. Really smart. Like, so if he's a quarter of a step slow, Riley, you'd say, well, his brain makes up for it.
Yeah,
exactly.
Which way? One thing I don't like, that kids aren't used to getting hit.
Yeah, right.
And I think, when we've seen a recent spate of shoulder injuries with one team that I cover, and they asked me about it, and I said, I'm not sure kids are used to getting hit enough. Like, they get the NHL, and you're allowed to make a hit. And I think of the hit that Trouba had on Athanasiou. And Athanasiou, there was a huge outcry from Athanasiou, like, you had your head down, you're saying 100 miles an hour, you can skate so much faster than me. And I stood up and made a perfectly clean body check. But because you're not expecting or used to getting hit, it provokes an outroar and an outrage. And it concerns me. I worry, and it's different in different areas about when hitting starts. In many ways, the first Flyers team I joined, about half the guys would have worn helmets in games. You didn't hit a guy up high when he had a helmet on. You didn't, without a helmet. You just didn't hit him up high. You didn't have a helmet on.
Yeah.
And there was a respect factor. And then when you saw, and while I played college, we went from no face gear to full masks after my second year.
Oh.
So all of a sudden, my second year, my third year, I had a full cage up. Well, now all of a sudden everybody was running head first into each other.
And yep.
No one had respect for the other guy, but no one had respect for their own head.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because they thought they were invincible. And so that part of it, like hitting from behind, when we were kids, you just didn't hit somebody from behind. And then it became a big deal, because you were taught to protect the puck, so you turn your back to the play. Well, there's some guys to this day, I don't care who they were, I'm not turning my back to them. Some of the guys I
yeah, play, yeah, yeah, right.
Ever.
Ever.
Like, I'm not turning back to them at a cocktail party.
Yeah.
So that part concerns me. I like hitting.
I think hitting should be a part of the game. I like the speed. I love the skill. From a goalie standpoint, I worry about goalies and injuries as well. And we're going to lose the idea of the ultimate number one goaltender. Those guys have to be so gifted and so special before they start to play. Then they have to have the work ethic and the training and everything. Then they have to have the size. So who are truly number ones in the National Hockey League right now? Connor Hellebuck is, Shesterkin is, Sorokin is, Vasilevsky is. You know, you might get to six or seven, you'd say arguably are truly number ones. UC Saros might be. But it's going to become a tandem, and it's going to become a tandem because of how physical the position is.
Right.
This seam pass, this bullet seam pass across, you know, I'm on a 2-on-1. I got a great shooting opportunity. Instead, I'm going to make a 60-foot bullet seam pass. The pass is harder than my shot was. It's perfectly placed, and then the next shot's going on the net equally hard. Well, think of physically what that does to a goaltender.
Oh, yeah.
And I think physically these guys are just going to have a hard time holding up. And if you watch how many teams have used 3 and 4 goaltenders this year, because physically the demands on these guys are crazy. And when they were going down in the butterfly, the surgery of rage was the hip, right? Everybody was having to have their hips done. But now you're seeing knees and yep. You're seeing, you know, when people ask me, could Carey Price come back? You know, it's the knee is the issue. I think it's the physical way the game has to be played by a goaltender now. He could come back to the old NHL. The new one moves far too laterally. You know, these seam passes, I love watching them, but oh my God, the seam passes that come across on a power play.
Oh, it's insane, isn't it?
It's crazy.
Yeah.
And then the ability to shoot the puck off the pass. You know, there were always guys with good one-timers, right? There were always guys, oh, he can shoot the puck. Just throw a blanket over now. Everybody can shoot the puck like everybody yeah. can. And so, you know, overall, I like the skill of the game. But I also like the thinking part of hockey. And we can't ever lose that. And yeah. And from a fighting standpoint, I think it'll leave the game organically. I don't want to rule it out. I think it'll leave the game. It is leaving the game.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
It's leaving the game, right? But I always felt from a respect standpoint that there was a place in the game for it.
Yeah.
Because you had to respect your actions. I couldn't hit you over the head with a stick, you know,
yeah.
because it would precipitate, you know, response.
Yeah, exactly. Right? That element of accountability is a very powerful one, right?
Absolutely, Riley. Absolutely. And because with accountability comes respect, right?
Yep.
And you knew going in, and you knew, I mean, you know, the role that you were so capable of, you also respected each other within that role.
Mm-hmm.
And you knew there were some guys that skirted the edges, but for the most part, I haven't met many tough guys that didn't have a great deal of respect for what they had to do to play the game, for the game itself. And how hard it was to play.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I guess that's the struggle I have with, I guess, the current game is like, it just seems to be a little bit less respect. Like there's just like in a lot of different forms. Yeah, it just bothers me. And I know we're not going to go back to the Broad Street Bullies. Not that I would ever suggest that would be an ideal situation, but it seems like that essence has been lost a little bit. Where maybe it's the culture that we're living in now. You know, I think we just become a little bit softer and things are a little bit, you know, a little bit easier. I'm not sure exactly, but I feel like that respect has been some bit forgotten.
Yeah. It's a challenge. There's no question about it. And, yeah. You know, and along the way, you know, when I was a college coach, the kid I would get into Notre Dame, number one, he'd be a great student. Number two, he'd be a great kid. Number three was the best hockey player from his area. And all of a sudden somebody had to say no to him. And that was me. Like, no, you're not in the first power play. Like, yeah. What do you mean? I've always been the first power play my whole life. Yeah. Well, you're not anymore. There's, you know, and you think of the first round draft pick coming in with Flyers and saying, you know, I'm on the first power play and say, no, we got a guy that does that. Right. Like,
Yeah, exactly. Know your role. Yeah.
I know you're the best in what you did, but you know, you get drafted by Edmonton and you've been a first power play guy your whole life, and they say, yeah, well, we have a guy who wears number 97, number 29.
He's okay. He's okay. They're both all right.
I know you were the best guy in, you know, Wausau, Wisconsin, or wherever you're from, but these guys are really good, and they're going to be on our power play.
Yeah, exactly. So true. I love the way you described, you know, the most skilled guy is not necessarily the best hockey player. And I think that gets lost, you know, where we're teaching the game now is like, it is just taught ultra skilled. And we've almost like forgotten to teach the hockey IQ or the essence of it. Because there's some things that'll never change within the hockey game that I feel like it's gone, you know, when you're teaching the game, it's gone so skilled. Like you're seeing like 5 and 6 year olds being doing incredible stuff with the puck, stuff that I, you know, never be able to do, you know,
even my son Elvis things. I mean, not that I played hockey, but you're right.
But like, you know, but when you're teaching the game, like there's some fundamentals that like will never leave. And that is the glue of the game. Yes. You need skill, you need speed and all that stuff now, but like you mentioned slowing the game down and being able to think the game, you know, thoroughly. I'm thinking some of the games guys I played with weren't the fastest, you know, but like, you know, I'm thinking like Kimo Thiemann and some of these guys just had the game way to slowing the game down. We're just thinking
even
the game
prongs,
so
a little bit. Is that, you know, prongs?
Yeah, prongs. Yeah, just like some of these guys, just like, but yeah, I like that you said that for you know any hockey dads out there, even young guys listening, because I think you can get caught up in all that skill and all the analytics and all this stuff, but you know the core of hockey is obviously competing, heaviness, you know, thinking the game thoroughly, because I think that's almost being lost when you're teaching the game to the youth now.
You need all the elements for sure, and you know you're looking at a team that wins, and you've got to have the elements. Mm-hmm. And it's not just pure skill; it's just not. There's a will factor involved in the game, and that's what makes it great. And I do. I mean, I really hope we never lose that. We can't ever lose that. The skill side of it is it's funny to watch. And the other thing I get is I like, you know, kids that play different sports. And
yeah,
I had a buddy of mine whose kid was a great baseball player and he was a goalie. And when he was like, he'd only been like 12 years old when the hockey coach was saying, well, you can't play baseball anymore. Now he's a big time baseball player, like one of the best in the city. And I said, you tell your hockey coach if he wants him bad enough as a goalie, then he'll get him when he gets him. And you keep playing baseball.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I don't know if you guys would even know this. And I don't want to digress here, but one of my favorite golfers is Jordan Spieth. Hmm. Do you know all the sports that Jordan Spieth played?
No, I've never heard.
He was a pitcher in baseball. He was a point guard. And he was a quarterback.
Wow.
And his brother played D1 basketball at Brown.
I didn't know that.
And I don't know, when I watch him golf, I think like he's just some of the shots he comes up with and some of the things he does, it just looks like he's an all-around guy.
Right? Yeah, right.
He's done other things. He's not just a golfer. And even his compete level, and, you know, he won so much early and, you know, and stepped back a little bit, but I think he'll be a force again. He's still a young guy. So I encourage other sports. Some of the best lacrosse players, like guys like Joe Nieuwendyk and Adam Oates was a great lacrosse player. You think about Oates, he passing a hockey puck, and you could just see the lacrosse, you know, that little thing.
Little snap.
That little, yeah, that little back and forth with the lacrosse stick. And you could just see Oates with his hockey stick dropping the shoulder 4 times before he actually passes the puck, you know, the deception involved in that. So, I've encouraged multiple sports.
I fully agree with that. You hear this in the strength and conditioning side of things. Like you want to draft athletes. Like you want an athlete, not just a one-dimensional hockey player. I think there's so much to be said. Thinking, you know, just different skill sets, different perspective. I fully agree with that. It's important for the youth to keep playing other sports for sure.
Absolutely.
Yep. Awesome, Dave. Well, you know, you're probably going to squeeze in a pregame nap before the game tonight. I don't know what you got going on.
Article
there,
to write, right?
My bad. Yeah.
Today's the deadline.
One or the other. So here's the strategy. I think golf goes on. The Golf Channel goes on in the background. They're out at Torrey Pines, which I love Torrey Pines, and I've had an opportunity to play it. So the Golf Channel will be on the background. I prepped the article. So now it's just sitting and figuring out how it's the start that's the hard part. Yeah. Got to put words down, then you can move them around, but you got to start and put words down.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, it sounds like you got it figured out. You got a nice structure to your schedule. And now we appreciate you hopping on, taking out the time, man. Really nice seeing you.
Yeah, this is great, guys. I enjoyed my time in Philly so much, and I enjoy always getting back there. Good luck with this, and good luck moving forward.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
Same to you.
All right, a big thank you to Dave Poulin. What a guy.
Nice. Great guy. Great guy. Captain, the Flyers. A couple good runs there while he was here, and appreciate him jumping on with us. Good dude, man.
Yeah, hell of a career. Not drafted. Playing career, coaching career.
Yep.
Definitely a good steward of the game.
Yes, for sure.
Now, it's that time. It is that time. And you got to wake it up.
For another bottle? Oh, clear on questions. The clear questions. Yeah. Not another bottle.
Put
one down already.
Yeah, you haven't asked.
Clearrum.com, baby. Baller.
Drew Tilly over on Twitter. He said he got a random one, but he wants to know why Nitty wore a plain white mask in his rookie season with the Phantoms.
Ooh, good question. Do you know the answer to that?
I didn't think he did. This was actually the mask he wore. His rookie year.
With the Phantoms?
Yes.
Hmm.
Because I didn't really understand it. It's a Finnish thing, and it didn't really match because it was red.
Maybe there was a game or two that he rocked the white? Or
He may have, man. I'd have to really go back and look at that. Sorry, I'd have to go back and look at that. But I remember Bob wearing a white one for a while. I actually have that mask as well.
Hmm.
But, gosh, I don't remember Nitty wearing a white mask for the whole year. Like I said, because he came with that one, and his other mask had a Phantom of the Opera on it the year you were there, his second year. So that's a good question. I really don't remember him wearing a white one that long, because, like I said, that was the one he wore. So I hope that answers. I don't know if it really answers
the
question.
That you had the helmet.
I actually had it right there. That's why I was like, do I have that one down here? But
impressive.
So he may have worn a white one for a while, but then that was the mask he wore most of the year.
All right.
Eric Simpson over on Instagram. If you're in a shootout and you run out of guys, can a goalie actually take a shot? Do you guys know?
I don't think
that's possible. Yeah,
I would say no.
I think the rotation just starts over, whoever you want to pick.
Elvis would say yes if he was in net because he wants to go down and try to snipe. But I don't know, though. Shesterkin, well, that one timer the other night, he took it, just missed the net, man. I don't know. He might be able to shoot the puck well enough to do that, but I don't think that's allowed.
I don't think so, no.
One last one. Matej Kubinek over on Instagram. Who's the best Slovak in Flyers history?
Ooh, wow.
What do you say, Nas? You've seen more of them than I have.
Oh, man. I have to really think about that.
Stefan Ruzicka?
Flyers history.
Yeah.
Mez comes to mind.
Michael Hanzus. Zeus would probably be favorite, right? Mez was a good play, hell of a player.
Yeah, right.
Actually, but I would say Baller. I would have to go with Hanzus. I can't think of which guy.
Bronco
Radulovic. Yeah, Bronco. Yeah, he wasn't here long enough. I actually liked his game. He was an energetic little fucker, but I would have to say Zeus. What a good dude, too.
Yeah, he was a good dude.
Zeus, a good man.
Yeah. Well, that's a wrap. Clear questions.
Clear questions. Check out Clear Rum on clearrum.com. Exactly.
Of course, Naz. And be sure to submit your questions if you guys got anything for us. Instagram, Twitter, YouTube. And be sure to subscribe if you guys are liking the content. Until next week. For episode 104, Nas, we're creeping.
104.
Check us out. Until then, stay safe, knuckleheads.
See you guys.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Are you ready for playoff hockey? Well, listen up, because I've got something for you. It's called the Daily Faceoff Playoff Parlay Challenge, and it's going to add some serious spice to your playoff experience. Now, here's the deal. Every playoff game day, you're going to be faced with four questions. It's like your own personal playoff puzzle. And here's a sneak peek into some of the questions we'll be firing your way. First up, you got to pick the winning team. Simple, right? But there's more. You gotta decide if the total for the game is going to go over or under a certain amount, and the strategy doesn't stop there. Next up, you're picking which player is going to light the lamp first, and finally, you gotta predict which period in the game is going to be the highest scoring. Will it be a barn burner in the first, a shootout in the second, or a nail biter in the third? That is all up to you. Now let's talk prizes, because who doesn't love winning stuff? Daily winners, you're getting hooked up with gift cards. That's right. Treat yourself to some nation gear or even your favorite jersey. And for the big dogs, the round winners, cash money. Cold, hard cash. We're putting real dough in your pockets simply for your hockey knowledge. So lace up those skates, stretch those thumbs, and get ready to show off your hockey IQ in the Daily Faceoff Playoff Parlay Challenge. It's game time, folks. Head over to games.dailyfaceoff.com now and prove your puck prowess.